So tonight's talk is called The Power of Intention. Something that Buddha put great emphasis on in his teachings. It was came comes right after right understanding in the Eightfold Path. So right understanding is understanding that how we live our lives in the conventional sense doesn't work. Probably the politest way of putting it, and that we start to understand, the three great things about that we need to understand, that everything is impermanent, that everything's unsatisfactory, and that this sense of a separate self is delusionary. We start to see that, even if we start on the sort of the intellectual level of just understanding it purely intellectually, we start to grasp there's something other, some other way of operating, thinking, functioning, living, and then we come to wholesome intention. We have decided that we're going to. We've seen through right understanding that we need to do something, and then with wholesome intention, we actually make choices and start to actually do something. It's important to understand another thing about intention, however, and that's that everything we do, every act of bodies and speech, must be preceded by the mental factor of intention. Like, I'm going to raise my arm. Before I could do that, I had to have the intention to raise my arm. Otherwise, my arm wouldn't have gone up. I'm going to say something. If I didn't have the intention to say these words wouldn't come out. Right? So intention is a very common mental factor. It's sort of like built right in. And it's so common that we don't see it often. We don't notice it at all. Because it's just always there. And it's fleeting in a sense. So, an intention in and of itself, the mental factor of intention, is totally neutral. Just the intention to do or say something. So, when we say we want to have wholesome intention, it implies that we have to make choices, hence the word wise intention, right? Intention to speak or act in ways that are wholesome, that lead onward towards liberation. And there's intention to do stuff that does the opposite. And a lot of what this practice is all about is simply learning to discriminate, to see, oh, I'm experiencing the intention to do something, and then looking at it and going, does this make sense? Is this wholesome? Is this onward leading? And that's a lot of all what we're trying to do, is just see intention arise and then choose whether to follow through with that intention or not. And a lot of intentions are really neutral, obviously. I have an intention to drink that glass of water that's sitting on the table with my dinner. Well, it's just like I'm thirsty, so I'm going to drink some water. It's not like wholesome or unwholesome. No, some people would argue drinking lots of water is very wholesome, but I mean, I'm not going to get into that. But just it's like a lot of things are very neutral, so we don't have to sort of like be too judgy. And the other interesting thing is that acts in particular that have no intention behind them have no karmic results, have nothing, they don't affect us in any way. So maybe some of you have been to parties over New Year's, and you're holding a glass of your favorite juice or whatever, and someone bumps you and you spilled some of it on someone. That was a totally unintentional act, and it's not like, oh, now you're going to suffer for the rest of your life because you spilled juice on this person, right? It's just like, it just something that happened. So the Buddha makes this very clear distinction about intentional acts and acts of speech and body, and unintentional acts. You know, it's like, you know, you go to the doctor, I don't know, I haven't had this done to me in a long time. You know, we used to test your reflexes and hit your knee with that little hammer and your leg would flip up. That's an unintentional act, right? So there's lots of different ways of thinking about it, looking at it. I want to share some things from a variety of sources. This is a book called Parami by Ajahn Susito. This is in a section called Small Enlightenments. So this is one look at intention. The Buddhist emphasis on knowing through one's direct experience has always felt very sane to me. The Buddhist Dhamma is shown not through this is truth, this is ultimate reality, and the secret law of the cosmos, but this is what you get, this is what you do to get through the mess. Which I think is a pretty good description of how we live our lives. We want to just get through the mess, right? And it offers an opportunity, a way to explore the mind and step back from the turmoil through the simple expedient of picking up a reasonable intention. A reasonable intention. Like focusing on breath and witnessing how the mind skids and wobbles around that intention with its transient likes and dislikes. So whatever form of practice we choose, you know, whether it's as simple as, you know, paying attention to the breath or various other forms of concentration practices or, you know, open awareness, these are all choices, right? Where we set the intention. Intention involves choice. And intention, intentional acts, are onward leading. This is a famous quote I like, you know. From intention springs the deed. From the deed springs the habits. From the habits grow the character. From the character develops destiny. So every time we set the intention to act wholesomely, we're setting a pattern. We're pattern creatures. We're creatures of habit. And so if we keep setting an intention that's wholesome repeatedly, then that becomes how we normally start to do it, whatever it is, right? And that then reflects our character, our how we are in the world in a general broad sense. And that affects our onward going progress in the path. It all starts every time we form an intention to do something that's wholesome. Every time we form an intention and look at it and choose. And intention can be, you can look at intention in two different ways. This is another way of looking at it. One, it could be like on the micro level. You know, there you are sitting, practicing, and you've decided, you know, that you're going to try and sit still. And then there you are just calmly sitting, and it's maybe 15, 20 minutes have gone by. And then you go, oh, my leg doesn't feel right. I'm going to move it. That's at the micro level, now you're making a decision. Am I going to actually move that leg, even though the intention has written? I've been mindful enough to see the intention to move my leg. But you also sort of set the sort of larger intention for this whole sitting period, I'm going to be perfectly still. So now, but now the intention to change that plan has arisen. And you go, oh, I can sit here and not move that leg. Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable, but you see what I'm getting here? Purely at the simplest level, intention can shift our practice. Just by seeing the intention arise and seeing it in the larger context of what's going on. Setting the intention to be still, by the way, I strongly advise. It's a really interesting way to look at the practice, because the stiller you are for the longer you are still, the more deeply concentrated the mind becomes. They're very tightly bound together, those two things. So this intention at that level, of the micro level of in this moment, I sense the intention. There's also, we can like set intentions. Like we can actually set an intention. I'm going to sit for 30 minutes, or I'm going to sit still, or whatever. Right at the very beginning of a practice period, I can set an intention for that practice period. And there's all kinds of different wholesome intentions. You can say, I think on this particular sitting period, I'm going to really try and just work with, some gatha of Thich Nhat Hanh, which I've been doing lately. And for that particular period, that's what it is. I work with this particular gatha I've been working with. So you can just, or I'm going to do, I think today I'm going to do metta practice instead of mindfulness. These are all intentions, right? But then, as I'm sure you've all experienced, because I know I experienced this, here it is, you're sitting there for a while, then you're thinking, I sit early in the morning, so for me it's like, oh, I'm starting to get hungry already, and there's still 15 minutes left. I said I was going to sit for half an hour, and I got that really good granola. I got it, Whole Foods. There goes the mind, right? And what you're wanting to do is break your intention, just like that. And that's when you have to go, no. I started off, I set the intention that I was going to sit for half an hour. I'm going to sit for half an hour. This is wholesome practice. So that, there's that broader intention. And then there's also, what we'll call long-term intention. At the longest of the long terms, it could be something like, I'm going to practice for the rest of my life. I'm going to form the intention to be consciously practicing the Buddha's teachings as long as I'm conscious. As long as I have a body mind that functions, that's what I'm going to do. That's an intention. It's a wholesome intention. As long as you don't turn it into, beating yourself up when you sort of lose contact sometimes and wander off and get caught up on other things. Then you just start again and reset the intention and start again. So you can have these sort of, very micro level intentions, or for one particular practice period intentions, or you can have like whole life intention. I want to read something from A Wise Heart by Jack Kornfield, who has some things to say about this. And he calls long-term intention, he gives it a special name, he calls it dedication, which I sort of like having a dedicated life, dedicating your life to the practice, the way of thinking about it. So this is what he has to say. Long-term intention is called dedication. In the forest monastery, we could gather before dawn in the candlelit darkness, and the monks would begin the sonorous morning chanting to dedicate our day. The chants reminded us that the path of awakening is possible when we dedicate ourselves to a noble way of life. We would dedicate ourselves to use the support we received for the awakening of compassion for all beings. So he's talking about the fact that in the monastic orders, they are totally supported by the lay people. So they would literally reflect on the fact that people are giving them their daily sustenance so they can practice. And that would encourage them to continue to deepen their intention, their dedication. He goes on, setting a long-term intention is like setting the compass of our heart. No matter how rough the storms, how difficult the terrain, even if we have to backtrack around obstacles, our direction is clear. The fruits of dedication are visible in the best of human endeavors. We can see them in political leadership of Nelson Mandela and Aung San Suu Kyi, Burmese teacher and politician, actually. In athletes like Michael Jordan, and artists like Yo-Yo Ma and Mary Oliver. I love the choice of those two. interesting combination. And that's true too, like to really be sort of deeply involved in anything, it takes a great deal of it. You have to set intention. You know, I'm going to work on my art every day. At times, our dedications are practical. To learn to play the piano well, to build a thriving business, to plant and grow a beautiful garden. But there are overarching dedications as well. We might dedicate our life to prayer, commit ourselves to unwavering truthfulness, or to work for world peace. These overarching dedications set the compass of our life, regardless of the outer conditions, to give us direction and meaning. I think this is so important, this idea of what we call overarching dedication. These days, with the chaos of the world around us these days, I mean, I keep looking, saying those words, but it doesn't seem to be getting any better lately. It's just the world is quite chaotic. And I'm so glad I have the intention to practice and to teach. It's like it keeps me grounded in the midst of everything that's going on. At least there's this solidity to having practice there, and helps keep my heart and mind calm and focused so that I can work skillfully with what's going on without getting overwrought or overly dramatic. But that's the result of dedication. You dedicate yourself to the practice. You actually then follow through with that dedication, and it gives you a solid base for the rest of life, whatever happens or doesn't happen in some cases, I'm sure too. There's another teacher I want to mention here. This is Saida Utejaniya, from his book When Awareness Becomes Natural. And he's talking about motivation. Motivation and intention are sometimes used synonymously in these teachings. So he tends to like the word motivation. But he asks really an interesting question here. This is the question I like to ask yogis. What motivates you to practice? This is sort of what I've just been talking about, but it's interesting to pause and go, why am I doing this? What am I doing here? I could be watching hockey. You know, instead I'm sitting here giving a Dharma talk, and you guys are all sitting there going, listening to me talk. We all could be doing something else. What motivates you to practice? Our answers are varied and always interesting. For some, it's just plain curiosity as to how the mind works. And for others, the motivation come out of a traumatic or painful experience. The option to meditate for these yogis is usually the only option. There's nowhere else to turn. Nothing else in their lives is working, and they want answers. Usually, the desire to meditate comes from a place of wisdom. The wisdom can be latent and only emerge when our backs are to the wall. Then it's a matter of recognizing that wisdom and making it work for us. To maintain and build on it takes mindfulness. Mindfulness with wisdom allows us to see what is causing our problems. On the surface level, our motivation to meditate can seem to come from sound intentions. However, hidden beneath can be many deeply rooted agendas that are not so sound. The mind can have some ideas that we don't recognize as we launch into and continue our attempts to meditate. It is important to check your attitude and motivations on a regular basis, as it's easy to forget. Am I wanting to experience a result from my practice? This is greed at work. However, there are pitfalls in checking too often, as it can create restlessness, which is also motivated by greed. So here he's pointing to the middle path. Like, it's wise to sort of look at your motivation once in a while, but if you look at it every day and it becomes like this habitual, oh my God, I got to make sure I'm motivated, it becomes restlessness. It's an interesting way to think about it, I think. It takes practice to find a balance. I once saw this yogi rushing to the Dhamma hall when the gong rang. I said, "Where are you going?" "To the Dhamma hall." "Why?" I said. "Because they rang the bell." Her motivation came out of habit. It was not because she wanted to meditate, but because the bell rang. Don't be a gong-following yogi. Look at your motivation and attitudes and ask the question, why am I doing this? Be alive to your being, your own experience. When one yogi was asked why she started meditation, she related how when she was younger, she was a naturally shy and introverted type of person. No one paid her much attention. Later, she took up meditation to draw attention to herself because it was different from what everyone else was doing. Once she started meditation, she found many beneficial side effects and carried on with the practice. She had tapped into her latent wisdom, which stimulated her interest and aroused delight in Dhamma. This drew her in and motivated her to carry on with more meditation. Hers was a case of starting with a dubious intentions. I want to do this because it looks good. But changing agendas as she deepened her practice. So our intention changes all the time. We all started with intention to practice. None of us would be doing this if we hadn't, that original intention hadn't arisen. And that's just the fact, right? So what is it that drew us here? And then the reason he says to keep checking in is our intentions start to change over time. And that's just natural. We hear the words the Eightfold Path, and we think of path as sort of like straight lines going someplace. But actually, the Buddhist teaching is very circular in some ways. At least the practice is very circular. We start to practice, we have some understanding, we have some intention. As we practice, as our practice deepens, our understanding deepens. And we go, oh. And then we start looking at our intention, and we're going, oh, yeah. And then our intention deepens and changes. And that's just natural, the natural cycle of this practice, to always keep coming back. Don't think of this as, the Eightfold Path as anything like a straight line. It's just that all the pieces are related to each other. As we go deep in our practice of some of the pieces, we then have to, we start looking at the other pieces and seeing things we just didn't see before. It's just like, that's a natural part of the process. This isn't straight line at all. Anything but. And in the end, and the Buddha says this in many places, says our intention has to be to move towards enlightenment. That's what this practice is really all about. It's and not I say moving towards. It's all about process. It's not like I'm going to be enlightened in the next 3 weeks, or whatever. You can't get caught there. You just have to understand that I can set the intention to move towards. And move towards might be just a little tiny bit. We used to quote his teacher. His teacher's name is Swami Sivananda. And Sivananda once said, if you're sitting and meditating and your mind wanders 20 times, and then after a couple of years of practice, you're sitting meditating and your mind only wanders 19 times, that's great improvement. And that's how we have to look at this practice. It's not like a short-term event. It's like that's that long-term dedication I was talking about earlier. It's like it's just a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. We're moving towards enlightenment. That's all we can do. And I want to go back to motivation a little bit. This is from the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada being this wonderful poetic collection of teachings of the Buddha. This is number 290. If you see a greater happiness that comes from forsaking a lesser happiness, be willing to forsake the lesser happiness for the sake of the greater one. This has to do with intention. A part of what intention is about is choosing to simplify your life, to let go of things that, though they might be pleasurable, aren't so onward leading, to consciously start making choices that might feel difficult at times because you're letting go of things, and instead, you know, choosing the greater happiness, you know, which is moving towards enlightenment. The flip side of that, there's another saying. It's like, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? And this is also true. It's like, how many times have I set an intention to do something? And then, well, you know, I'm going to sit for 30 minutes, example from earlier on. It could be as simple as that, or it could be something larger even. It's like we set intentions and then we don't follow through. And we have to be very aware of that and be conscious that setting an intention is something we have to be serious about. I'm going to talk a little more about that in a little bit. But I want to read a little bit from Joseph Goldstein here. And he's talking about, in a sense, how to set intentions. You can reflect on what first awakened your interest in your own journey of understanding. Was it some deep experience of personal suffering? Was it compassion for the suffering of others? Was it some inner groping for meaning or purpose in your life? Sometimes we lose touch with what first inspired us. It can help us to reconnect to that initial interest and inspiration. Doing so can rekindle the fire of effort, of passion, for that amazing path of waking up and becoming free. Other places in the teachings, what he's referring to here, like going back to our original intention, is an antidote to doubt. You ever been caught in doubt? Like caught in that space of, God, I don't know, I've been doing this for a long time, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere, and why am I doing this, and blah, 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 blah. I've been there a few times. And if you go back to your original intention sometimes, and maybe even rephrase it because you know more now, as I suggested earlier, just that in and of itself can almost sometimes just break doubt completely. Just going back to that original intention. Why am I doing this? Oh, okay, that makes sense. And the doubt just goes away. So a chief antidote to doubt is reviewing and resetting intention. Then Joseph goes on. Without the fire of effort, nothing happens. We simply live out and act out all the old habit patterns of our conditioning. It is extremely difficult to set aside these habits, to discern in a clear, fresh way what is actually occurring, and to make choices based on wisdom rather than on reactive conditioning. But effort alone is not enough. Valuable as this quality is, it can also lead us astray if it is overdeveloped. We can become attached to the goal of enlightenment and become very ambitious with a kind of spiritual competitiveness, or a strong self-judgment about our progress. We can strive and strain with an excessive urgency that can become desperation. Wanting something to happen right now gets in the way of clear seeing. It leads to frustration, disappointment, even despair. Joseph tells this really funny story about this sort of thing. When he was originally sitting in India with the teacher there, and there was a men's hall and a women's hall, and the men nobody had rooms, but they had like partitions, so like canvas side and partitions on three sides, and then a bed and a little space for a desk and a light there. And he set the intention, because he was really going to be really serious. Yeah, he set the intention that he was going to be the last person to turn out their light every night. He was going to stay up and practice and study until he was going to be the last person for sure. And every night he'd be there, he'd reset the intention, and you know, three or four people down from him, in down the row, there was some other person who had their light on, and he'd, you know, I'm going to stay a little bit later, I'm going to stay a little bit later, I'd set the intention, and every night he would finally just have to give up, and because he was falling asleep sitting up, he'd turn out his light and go to sleep. And at the end of the retreat, he was talking to the guy who was from three or four cubicles down, and he said, "You know, every night I tried to stay up as long as you, but I always had to turn on my light and go to sleep, and your light would still be on." And the guy sort of looks at him kind of funny, and he says, "Oh no, I just like to sleep with my light on." Oh. And the whole retreat, he'd been beating himself up for not being, you know, for his intention. And it was just like, that's what he's talking about, what an unwholesome intention. It's like, and clinging to it, like, I have to be the best, right? Then he goes on, recognizing, often through painful personal experience, the difficulties that come from such striving, expecting mind. Many people discard the notion of goal altogether. This is also a mistake. If we abandon the sense of goal and become attached to the idea that practice is simply becoming aware and mindful in the moment, without any sense of destination, development, or deepening realization, then we lose a source of tremendous energy and inspiration. So we have to set the goal to move towards enlightenment without becoming overzealous and attached to it. Tricky middle ground. Here we are. Here's the middle way again. Huh? The critical balance we need to discover in meditation practice, and indeed in all aspects of our life, is the equipoise between effort and surrender. On the surface, these two qualities seem to contradict each other. How can we make effort, be purposeful, and at the same time surrender to what is happening, to the natural unfolding of our experience? Grasping this paradox is a decisive turning point in coming to understand the whole spiritual journey. Surrender does not mean passive resignation. Rather, it means surrender to the Dhamma, to the truth of the moment's experience. Such acceptance enables us to arouse energy, but without agitation or grasping. We have a sense of spiritual urgency, while at the same time we soften and surrender to just what is happening in this moment, and then this, and then the next one. So it's an interesting take on setting intention wisely. And in that broad dedication sense that Jack Kornfield was talking about. I just want, this is sort of almost an aside, but intention is also something we can actually note. You know, if you're meditating and you have a noting practice, then, you know, there you are in the intention to move, or the intention to cough, or the intention to whatever arises. You can just note the intention. And then, because you see the intention itself has arisen, then you always have choice. Often, especially in terms of physical movement, we often are moving when we're doing formal practice without ever seeing the intention that started out that process. Remember, every act of body speech are always preceded by the mental factor of intention. So if we can start, and we don't want to become like fanatic about, I got to see intention to everything, right? Yeah. You know, it's like, I'm going to sit here and not move. I'm not going to blink. I'm not going to do anything. because I can't see the intention to have that happen, so I'm not going to let it happen. Well, you can make yourself pretty crazy pretty quickly doing that. So you have to sort of balance this out with, like, it's just another thing, another mental factor that arises, and sometimes you'll see it really clearly, and then you go, oh, now I have a choice. And that's both in your practice and in your life out in the world. You know, you're in the midst of some group of people and they're all talking about something, and you feel the intention arise to say something that you think is very wise and really very relevant to the conversation. And then you go, oh, is my intention to actually add anything to this conversation, or is my intention to look brilliant because I said some amazing thing? Two different intentions. And so there I am judging, is my whole intention to speak at this moment wholesome? This is wise intention in action, right? So then there's another sort of layer of intention that I want to talk about, partly because it's this time of year, and that's resolve. You know, this is like we think of, oh, well, it's New Year's, got to set some resolutions. Resolve is like a firm intention. It's almost like, if we were monastics, we'd call them vows. I'm going to do this for sure. No doubt, absolutely certain, I'm going to do this. That's resolve. It's different from intention. Intentions are wholesome, but they don't have, I mean, resolve has a sort of firmness to it, a solidity to it. Like, I'm going to do this. My dad had this phrase, he said, I'm going to do this come hell or high water, which I thought was sort of, it's like, it's going to happen for sure, right? And, you know, we think of that in terms of, you know, New Year's, right? New Year's resolutions. And I wanted to say really emphatically, resolutions, you don't have to wait another 354 days now to make more resolutions. Resolutions are something that you can do anytime. Literally, you know, there you are, middle of April sometime, and you feel a real strong intention arise, and you want to sort of solidify it in a sense, and you make it into a resolution. Consciously go, no, this isn't just a good idea, this isn't an intention, this is something I want to, you know. And there's some really interesting things you can do. One of my old teachers, Swami Vishnudevananda, used to have us every New Year's would write down our resolutions for the year. Actually write them down. And it's interesting because just in the act of writing them down, they became more real. You know, he even said, you know, you write down your resolution and sort of make it in the words of like a contract. And then sign it, you know, and post it on your fridge or whatever, whatever works, right? To actually, it just makes things more official. And the thing, something about our mind and official acts that, you know, so we can actually do something about this. And then, if you make a resolution like this and you write it down, then make sure on a regular basis you go, oh, how am I doing with this? Am I actually following through with this resolution I made a month ago, 2 months ago, yesterday, whatever? And that sometimes, like, make it a habit. You know, put it in, you know, if you're like, I still have a book when I write down things I'm going to do every day. And so, you know, maybe in your book you put a little symbol that says, you know, check your resolution symbol, and once a week you come across, oh, I should, how am I doing with that resolution I made last week or the week before or 10 weeks before? Something that reminds you to check up on yourself, literally. Not to, and the other thing is about resolutions is you should be realistic. You know, you might think, you might be in one of your real serious moods, and you might think, I've been meditating every day now for 45 minutes, but I should set a resolution. I'm going to meditate every day for 2 hours. That might not be a realistic resolution. And you're just setting yourself up to disappoint yourself. And then, oh well, this doesn't work, this stuff, blah, blah, blah. So it's like, it might be fun if you meditated for an hour, 45 minutes every day, to say, let's just resolve to meditate for 55 minutes every day. Add enough that it's going to be difficult, but not so difficult that it's not going to work. And also, we have to make sure with resolve that we're actually resolving to do something that is onward leading. Resolves could be, I could resolve, I'm going to sleep in every day, to heck with the sitting up, getting up early in the morning to practice. Yeah, I couldn't resolve that, but it would not be onward leading, right? So we have to be conscious, And then the last thing you have to do, if you set resolves, or just intentions for that matter, is that sometimes, life gets in the way, or we're going through a tough time or whatever, and all those intentions and resolves we had just didn't happen for a day, a week, a month, who knows. Then just start again. The thing I've realized more about this practice than anything else over the last couple of years is that's really what all, sort of one of the key things about this practice, is just you just keep starting again. And again, and again. Whether it's I'm sitting, and I've just decided to, pay attention to my breath and note what's arising, and my mind wanders, and I can either, when I notice my mind's wandering, I can sort of, oh God, I beat my, what's wrong with me, blah blah blah, or I can just start again. And that's all we can ever do, whether it's on the momentary basis like that, or on a daily basis, or a weekly basis, or whatever basis. So it's really wholesome to set intentions that form firm resolves. But don't beat yourself up when something throws you off. Just start again. It's really all we can ever do is just start again. Last thing I want to mention about resolutions. And I forget where this quote came from, but it says, a person has four grounds for resolve. In other words, here's, grounds. These are things we can base our resolutions on. The resolve on wisdom, on truth, on relinquishment, and on calm. Interesting list, huh? So, and our resolution should be based on one or more of these. So wisdom is a better understanding of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. That's what wisdom in this tradition really comes down to. So we could actually resolve to see if we can come to a better understanding through our practice and our life experience of those three things. That could be a resolution, a very wholesome resolution. Truth. We can resolve on truth. Living in a way that is always truthful, including being aware of your own faults. That's a tough one to be truthful about, but that's like, can I live a life where I'm always acting truthfully, both with others and with myself? That would be quite an interesting resolve to take. Relinquishment. Giving up things that aren't necessary. Now, this is the classic New Year's resolution, right? It's going to be the dry January, right? No alcohol for a month, or whatever. Those are the classic ones that we see. But it's like relinquishment, letting things go, can be quite wholesome. If we set a resolve to let go of whatever, And we all have bad habits. And can I take the resolve to let go of a bad habit? That might even be something I kind of enjoy. And if I can relinquish that, that can be a very wholesome thing. So that's something you can resolve on. And then calm. We can resolve just on making choices that lead toward a calmer life and mind. You know, there's all things, you know, I used to spend a lot more time reading the New York Times than I do now. You know, because I actually set a resolve, no, I'm not going to read the whole New York Times. I'm not going to read all the political stuff. I'm going to read little bits of it, and then I'm just going to put it, you know, I give myself 10, maybe 15 minutes a day, and that's it. I actually formed a resolve to do that a couple of years ago. It's been very helpful because I still am aware enough that I can sort of catch the things that are important without getting riled up yet again by all that's going on. I can sort of keep it in perspective. So just think of when if you're forming intentions, forming firmer resolves, keep these four ideas. You know, you can resolve on wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and calm. These are things you could make resolves about or set intentions to change. So what I'm trying to get at here is that our intentions, setting wise intentions, is a way in some sense to take some limited control. I won't say take control because we can never control our whole life, but we can take some limited control over certain aspects of our life that are going to work most of the time anyway. And this is a way to actually start changing our practice and our life. Intention power is a powerful thing that allows us to start shifting little by little our lives and how we act and speak and live in the world and how we practice. So it's something we need to be aware of and constantly think about how we can form wholesome intentions. This is a little bit of poetry to end. This is Mary Oliver from her book Evidence. It's called Mysteries, yes. Truly we live mysteries too marvelous to understand. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity. While we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Here's a good resolve. You know, let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. Seems like a good resolve to me.